give me a G. G, give me an A. A, give me an M. M, give me a B. B, give me an A. A, give me an N. N, what's that spell? A gamban, clap your hands. For gamban, clap your hands. That's right. This episode is presented by Gamban, as well as Epic Risk Management. Don't forget about Epic Risk Management. And I hope you enjoy this episode of the podcast.
Hello and welcome to All in the Addicted Gamblers Podcast. My name is Brian, and I have not placed a bet since July of 2014. And with me today is the Community Engagement Liaison for the Nevada Council on Problem Gambling. Ted Hartwell is here. Ted, how are you? Thanks for doing this again.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, yeah, of course. I can't get enough of talking about this subject. We just did our 300th episode not too long ago, so you'll be somewhere after 300. So I didn't think we'd ever get there, but I'm happy that there's people who keep wanting to talk, and I love it when people come back on, because then we can talk about even more than we did last time.
Absolutely.
Ted, would you remind everybody about your own gambling and your date of recovery?
Absolutely. So I am someone with who is in long-term recovery from a gambling problem. I made my last bet on September 14th, 2007. At Green Valley Ranch Station, right here in Las Vegas. And prior to that, I had several years of fairly out of control gambling that was preceded by an even longer period of recreational gambling, where I was able to control it and set those limits of money and time. And so, when it did start to get out of control, it was very confusing at first, long before it became a financial impact in my life. I remained convinced for a very long time that I should be able to get back to that period of control I'd once had. So that, I think, delayed my reaching out for help for quite a while. My gambling started when I was 10 years old, pretty young. Learned to gamble in the family. My dad taught me how to bet on the horses and taught me how to play poker, and got more and more involved with poker games all the way through college. And then after I finished graduate school, got offered a job in Las Vegas and moved out here. After quite a few years of just having fun, a few things happened in my life that were a little bit traumatic and a common story, I think. And all of a sudden, this thing that was once recreational became a way for me to escape from dealing with things that were going on in my life. And from there, it spiraled out of control.
Jeez. For as many times as I hear people say the word spiraled, and I'm like, it's just so true every time. Because you just think, I look back at my own gambling, and I just think there were so many opportunities to stop and to really stop and to avoid all the harm that I did eventually come into. But that word spiraling is just so accurate. It just really does spiral out of control. What is the problem gambling helpline for Nevada, for anybody out there struggling with a gambling addiction or is just curious in general?
Sure. So we use the National Problem Gambling Helpline that is associated with the National Council on Problem Gambling. So that number is 1-800-522-4700. And that number actually is, I believe, written into the statute in Nevada as one that has to be used and posted, for example, near the ATMs or casino cages of gaming licensees in the state of Nevada, as well as in informational brochures that they are required to maintain and make available and visible, or at least they're supposed to be visible. In some cases, they're a little bit hidden. That's the number that we use in Nevada.
When someone calls that number from Nevada, does it route them? It's the national line. So how does that work? As long as they're in Nevada, it routes them back to the help that's in Nevada?
That's right. So right now, that number, no matter where you call, from the United States, it will route you to the nearest call center based on the area code you are calling. And of course, that presents a few challenges because now as people move around and they take their cell phones with them and they don't change their numbers, that might get them initially to a call center that's out of the region that they, you know, actually live in or play in now. But they're working on revamping some of these issues so that that geolocation will be used to route that person to the nearest call center where they actually are. And then if they are just visiting, of course, they can be connected to a resource that's in the area that they live in. But in the case of Nevada, when you call from that 702 area code, you are routed to the call center in Louisiana, which may sound very strange at first glance, but they are one of the most, mature in terms of how long they've been a call center, their training requirements, kind of the ethics that are written into that, the training and suicidality, things like that, that are very important for somebody who may be in significant distress as a result of a gambling problem. But they are equipped, of course, with all of the resources that we have locally in Nevada, both in terms of things like 12-step meetings or any formal treatment. And if that individual is in immediate distress, they will work to keep that person on the line and contact, in some cases, the casino property that that individual may be calling from, and you know, have security come and engage them and help them out right away. So in some cases that happens where you need to get that person some immediate assistance.
That would be incredible if that happened everywhere, where you could call and a number and all of a sudden security walks over to help you with something, rather than it's all that shame and stigma that you're sitting there in the casino and you think, I don't want to, it's a hard place to then call the number from.
Absolutely. I look forward to the day when we've reduced that enough to, you know, where people don't get to that point, right? Where they're considering ending their own lives over their gambling, and that they recognize that it's a problem, but also that there's lots of help out there. And, you know, that help, and whether it's something, you know, self-help like a 12-step meeting or the formal treatment or some combination, is often very, very successful for people who will, you know, make the commitment to engage in it, whatever that looks like. So those are really important messages to get out there, because people often feel so alone, especially with a gambling disorder.
I placed my last bet in Las Vegas. I was living in California at the time, but I was driving to Las Vegas. And so when that ended and I was able to, I left, partially because I feel like I had worn out my own welcome in California through the gambling, right? I've turned my life into what I thought was going to be a new start into just, well, now it's synonymous with gambling for me. When I think back at my time in California, because I was driving to Las Vegas all the time. I was able to move. I moved from there to North Carolina. And as far as I knew, I was in this great big bubble, which I was. It was about 5 or 6 hours to the nearest casino from where I was. So I was in a good bubble there. You weren't given that opportunity. You couldn't just leave when you discovered that you had a gambling addiction. What is it like to live in Las Vegas, the gambling epicenter of the states, with...
Yeah, it's such a great question, because I get that so often, and I often get it also from people who are just getting into their recovery process, whatever that looks like for them. And sometimes they say, you know, I just need to get out of Vegas or get out of Nevada, and then I'll be okay. And so I, you know, usually when I get that question or have that conversation, I remind people that some form of gambling is legal in 48 of 50 states. And in those two states where it is illegal, Hawaii and Utah currently, there are still lots of illegal opportunities to gamble if one so chooses. So I always encourage people to get well in the place where they develop that addiction first. I mean, we've got, I think, some of the some of the world's best treatment right here in Las Vegas. We've got over 100 12-step meetings focused on gambling here in Las Vegas. Tremendous recovery support and community here. And I tell them, get a year under your belt, engage in these, in your recovery process. And if a year from now you still feel the same about wanting to get out of Vegas and move somewhere else, you take those tools with you no matter where you go. But if you don't get well and you just run somewhere else, you run the risk, of course, of taking yourself with you and, still possibly falling prey to whatever opportunities might be in that jurisdiction that you've been.
Yeah, that was, that's why I had moved to California. I was getting out of the Detroit metro area because I was just gambling at all the casinos there. And I just thought, let me get a fresh start. And unfortunately, I was not ready to stop gambling. But luckily for me, it came about 6 months after I moved there, where that was the end. That was the end. So I guess if I hadn't moved there, who knows where I'd be. But I had to get to extreme harm to be able to stop, which sucks, yeah. But did happen. I also, in my GA meeting in Michigan, I was in there with a gentleman who had lived in Las Vegas, and he would always say that some of the best meetings are in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I think that's true. One of the first things I do whenever I travel, whether it's in the US or abroad, is I go online and see if there is a local meeting, right, that I can get to. And sometimes if there's not one for gambling, then I'll go to another 12-step meeting where I'm often welcomed. Some will let me share, some will not, depending on how they strict they are, or if it's about a substance or something like that. But I always feel, it's kind of the home away from home for me. I'm immediately welcomed. I recognize the language, the problems are the same, the experiences are the same, and the fellowship in that group is the same, right? People really there to help themselves and help one another learn, what works in beating this kind of baffling hidden addiction. And so that's remarkable. And I'll just share it. Gosh, if I could, one story about being, in recovery that very first year. I don't think I had quite a year under my belt. And I took a trip to Jamaica with my family. I knew there were some casinos down there, and I kind of wondered if there were a GA meeting. And so I got online, and there was a number. It didn't list any meetings, but there was a number. And so I called that number before I left, and somebody answered and said, well, yeah, we'd love to, put together a meeting for you, which sounded a little weird. It's like, well, put together a meeting for me. I don't know. And he says, well, just here, call me when you get in. And what I didn't realize that their regular meetings happened on the Kingston side, which is on the opposite side of the island from where most of the resorts are that people go and have a vacation. And so when I got there, I called and these three men who had never met me, didn't know me from Adam, drove over an hour from the other side of the island to come to me and put together this this little meeting. And then after that, they took me to dinner and showed me the local spots I might not have engaged with as a tourist. And later on, one of them would actually visit Las Vegas for his work to a conference. And he was just terrified about coming out to Vegas, being in recovery. And he said, hey, I'll take you to a couple great meetings. We'll get together for a meal. And we did. And so, that's just kind of one of the really cool things about the recovery community in this area, or any area, I suppose.
Yeah, you always have a friend.
For
wherever
sure.
You go, as long as there's a meeting. That's fantastic. What a great story. One of the things that always helps me is simply talking about my addiction, which I've realized after doing so many podcasts. I really enjoy talking about it. And that's what helps me. It's not, I'm glad people get something from it, but I talk about it because it helps me. Why do you talk about your addiction, and how have you grown so comfortable in talking about something so painful?
Oh, it's a great question. And I love the service you're providing, by the way, because I think it's through conversations like this that we really destigmatize the conversation around addiction in general, but particularly around gambling addiction, which is has that further level of stigma. And I think I do it for the same reasons you do. It's, you know, to normalize the discussion. We have normalized gambling in this country to an incredible degree, and we still continue to see that process happening right now, right? And so we need to normalize the discussion around the collateral damage that can occur to that small percentage of people who are affected. I can remember the very first time I outed myself publicly. As I got into, you know, early recovery, there were a couple colleagues that knew about it at work. I went through my employee assistance program to find somebody who was trained in treating it. Ultimately, even though the previous 2 years, you know, I had, you know, my disease had talked me out of really going to anybody with actual experience. I was really trying to resist the idea that I just couldn't gamble normally anymore. And when I finally did connect with that organization and go through an intensive outpatient program here at the Problem Gambling Center in Las Vegas, you know, I came out of that feeling so good that I told a couple of colleagues about it, first of all, because they'd kind of wondered where I'd been or why I'd only been there half days for the, you know, previous 6 weeks or so. And so I talked about it with them, and they were, you know, actually very supportive. And then after I had about a year under my belt, I was very interested in doing volunteer work in the community. Nevada ranks about, I think, 51st behind all of the other states and Puerto Rico in terms of our volunteerism rates. And so I thought this will be a good way for me to kind of give back to the community, keep myself engaged in positive ways that aren't going to lead me back to gambling. And I found a program that really appealed to me called CASA, C-A-S-A, which stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates. In some states, it's called Guardian Ad Litem, but it's a program of volunteers who advocate for children who are in the foster care system as a result of abuse and neglect. And the goal is for you as the volunteer to advocate for them in court in their best interests and hopefully get them out of the foster care system and into a safe and permanent home as soon as possible, whether that's with a parent or an adoptive resource or a group home or whatever it happens to be. And I thought, well, this sounds really interesting. I'm going to get trained, and it's about 35 hours of training. It's a lot of training, but there's a whole unit on addiction, because it turns out in about 90% of cases where kids are removed from the home, at least here in Nevada, there, you know, addiction of some kind is a running theme in the background and is the reason for that abuse or neglect. And so I thought this is a really good way to kind of keep myself on the straight and narrow. I had a little girl who was just, you know, 4 years old or so at the time. And, you know, one of the things that kind of woke me up and finally got me to get into recovery is the idea that I was going to lose my family and particularly access to my little girl and possibly not see her again, right, if I kept going down this path. And I remember sitting in that training, and we got to the unit on addiction, and it was entirely focused on substances. You know, they talked about all different kinds of substances and alcohol and illicit drugs and the potential effects and what this led to. And I found myself thinking, man, we're sitting here in Nevada. Should I mention gambling? I didn't know what to do. And finally, I just raised my hand and I asked the instructor if I could talk about gambling a little bit. And she said, sure. You know, and they had interviewed me, so they already knew this about my background a little bit. And so that was the first time I outed myself in a public way with 30 other people in a class. And I said, let me tell you a little story and how it affected my life and my interaction with my family and what I've, you know, some of the stories I've heard from other people. And I think it's really important that that we're all aware that this is something that often occurs at the same time. And I'm not even sure if I knew that then. Maybe I didn't say that, but I said, this can be a very serious addiction. And I remember I was a little bit nervous, but the sky didn't fall. Everybody was very supportive. And it was at that point that I kind of resolved to You know, look into volunteering with the Nevada Council on Problem Gambling, see what programs they had. I went to their state conference and I met Carol O'Hare, who's the executive director of the Nevada Council. And she took me under her wing and told me about different community programs. And so I started administering those. And again, the sky didn't fall, and a bunch of other opportunities, quite frankly, have opened up in my life as a result of that. And we need more public faces and voices for this particular addictive disorder, because you know, we have elite athletes and celebrities and even past presidents who will allude to their struggles with substances, but we're not quite there in the gambling realm, even though we know as a society of certain athletes or celebrities who are said to have pretty serious gambling problems, and we hear about them being, you know, suspended from teams. But as far as coming out, speaking from a standpoint of having had that problem and where they got help and how they got better, we still don't have a lot of voices out there. So while I'm not an elite athlete or celebrity, certainly, you know, I can certainly be a public voice, and I'm well known in the communities that I run in Las Vegas. And so I think that's just part of the process that helps, again, normalize conversation around this illness, just like, you know, just like any other illness that we're much more comfortable talking about, you know, heart disease, diabetes, what have you. So I know that's another long answer. So you got to be careful what you ask me, Ryan, because I will just go on and on and on.
I think you are selling yourself short, because you might not be a professional athlete, but you are a professional musician.
That's true.
And I'm, you know, as much as addiction happens in many walks of life, I'm sure it also happens in the musical realm of life. And so, you know, you never know who you're going to run into in your work or in your musical life that might need to know your story.
That's true. And in fact, there have been a lot of second and third hand contacts that have come about through the entertainment industry here in Las Vegas, of people who just found out via a Facebook post I put out there, or just, you know, my personal story, who have reached out, often on behalf of a family member that they're concerned about. And so those things are really gratifying. You know, I know that that occasional blurb I'll put out on social media is having some effect, because people will connect back. And later on, I mean, there's a wonderful musician who's a friend now here in town, whose wife reached out to me quite a few years ago. And, you know, he ended up going through the same program I did and is doing very well and still performing today. And one of my favorite school groups to talk to in town is Las Vegas Academy, which is a performing arts high school here in town. And so I love to come in and talk to the kids and develop that immediate rapport when I talk about being a professional cellist with the Las Vegas Philharmonic. Some of them occasionally have parents who are in the Philharmonic, you know, or are teaching. And of course, they're aspiring to go on to be some type of, if not a performance musician, dance or theater and in those areas. And so it immediately grabs their attention, and they pay a lot more attention to me when I'm talking about these other issues. And the kids who write thank you notes about the presentations I give in schools, it's amazing what's already going on in the home that they will share about in those thank you notes. And so it's often a family member who's struggling with a gambling problem, and they're wondering, you know, where to get help. And sometimes the kids will take these resources back to the families, and that's how a family member gets help. So it's just about what you're doing, right? Having this conversation with folks and hoping people get the message.
You mentioned the phrase intensive outpatient, I believe. And I myself took part in an IOP program. It just ended for me because I've started a new job, but so I had to stop going to the intensive outpatient program. But I had a mental health crisis last September and ended up in an IOP program, and it was just the best. I can only imagine what that would be like for gambling specific. We'd go around the room from time to time and introduce ourselves because we get new people. And I wasn't in there for gambling, but my the gentleman who was running the meetings, you know, it would get to me and I'd just say, oh, I'm in here for suicidality and this and that. And he would go, and Brian, what was your addiction? And I'd say it out loud. And I was generally the only one with a gambling addiction, but then it would bring up this conversation and you'd hear other people go, oh, you know how people will just automatically say somebody has an addiction because they know how they are. Oh, my brother-in-law has a gambling addiction, but he won't get help. And it would stir up those thoughts. I had back procedure done on my back and they said, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a gambling addiction advocate. And then the conversation while they're sticking needles in my back turned into a conversation about gambling in Connecticut and what kind of help there is. So you're right. You just never know. You just never know who's listening. And so
one of my pipe dreams is for, you know, those doctors who are administering your care, you know, it's, we go to that annual checkup, right, with our primary care physician and what are those pre-screening questions they ask us about, right? They ask us, do we drink alcohol? If so, how often? Are we on any medication? Are you taking any illicit drugs? Is there domestic violence in the home? I would just love to hear one or two questions. Could be very innocuous. Have you noticed an increase in your gambling recently, right? A very simple question that is going to give a lot of people pause. It's like, why are they asking me that? But it's also non-threatening and might, for some people who are starting to develop a problem, or maybe have been in it for a while, but nobody else has ever asked them a question or confronted them. It's like, wow, this must be a real thing. My doctor is asking me about it. There must be help, right? And so making that little connection, so important.
Such a good point. And I know screening day is a big deal. And we just had that, I think, the 8th. Is it the 8th or the 9th?
Yes. I think it was the 8th this year.
I did a whole podcast on it. I don't know why. I can't remember which day it is. The 8th or the 9th. And I just such an important part, because had somebody, like you said, I didn't say it out loud to anybody. It wasn't until my friend said it out loud to me that I realized, oh, I'm showing my cards, right? He knows about my addiction. And if I had just known before that, or if somebody else had made me aware that they're aware, that does a lot for the brain, for the psyche. Like, oh, I'm not getting away with this at all. Somebody else can see that this is bad for me.
Right.
You guys have your annual, is it annual or do you do 2 a year conference coming up?
It's annual. Yes.
And it's in, when is it?
So that's going to be May 5th and 6th. I believe that's a Thursday and a Friday, but don't hold me to it. Matter of fact, I'm going to pull it up on my phone while I'm talking about it, just to be sure that I don't give people the wrong.
Very thorough of you. I appreciate it.
Might be in the, yeah, that's 5th and 6th. That's a Thursday and Friday. And it's a, you know, jam-packed meeting filled with presentations on everything from recovery to research to treatment. I'll be giving a presentation on gaming disorder, talking about the overlap between video games and gambling. What does healthy gaming behavior look like? What are some of the features that we're concerned about that have very gambling-like effects in the brain, and especially exposure of young people to some of those features, and also where to get, you know, training and help for that as well. So I'm looking forward to that. And we'll also have a couple legal talks. Judge Cheryl Moss will be talking about the Gambling Treatment Diversion Court and her efforts to get that going in other states around the country.
Love Judge Moss.
Yeah. We've even got a law student who's going to present some legal, I think there'll be legal arguments from case studies as to why I think this is where she's going, why the industry bears a little more responsibility than perhaps regulations have. That's what am I trying to say? Regulations have caused them to be involved to this point, right? And I know we've got a lot of great people in the industry who treat this issue very, very seriously, and sometimes even they are a little bit hamstrung by, you know, internal processes and desires. And I've had those conversations as well. But it seems like there needs to be a little more attention in the regulatory realm to this as an issue, especially in terms of federal funding, for which there is none, but even at the state level, you know, recognizing this formally as a public health issue that affects a lot more people than just the person with the gambling problem, obviously. So we could do 10 other podcasts on that. But
amen, Ted. Amen. I concur. I would love to see that. Are you guys doing it virtually as well, or is it just in person?
It will be just in person. We're a fairly small team, very dedicated and passionate, but you know, our funding levels, everybody is surprised to learn in Nevada that, you know, we're kind of the gold standard for the integrated resort casino industry. We should be the gold standard for problem gambling awareness and education and funding and treatment, but really we fall kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of state funding across the country. So we do a lot with the little that we're given. So we haven't quite ramped up to the online conference world yet, although we will have one or two presentations that are being presented remotely to the audience that will be there in person. We did actually, we skipped, of course, 2020 because of the pandemic, but we did have an in-person conference last year that was kind of wonderful. It was reduced to just about 100 people or so, but it was nice to see everybody in person at that time when we'd all been separated for so long, and we're looking to maybe double that in attendance for this year's. But it'll be a great conference, and it's heavily subsidized too by the State Problem Gambling Fund. So for $75, you can register for 2 full days of great presentations, get 12 CEUs if you are in a category or a profession where you need those education credits, and get 2 fantastic meals at lunchtime as well. So it's a pretty good deal.
You're a good salesman, sir.
All right.
All right. Since we're saying it, where can people go to register if they're in the area and can make it?
So they can go to nevadacouncil.org. I think whenthefunstops.org will also get them there. And there will be information on the website on how to register for that.
There it is right there. Yep. Right at the top.
Excellent. So that's the easiest way to do it.
I am glad to see you guys are doing your conference in May. I think some people get conferenced out in March when they have all of them. And so it's nice that there's some others spread around to get the spring conference session going. So good for you guys for doing it a few months later. You get a little more attention. When I first saw that your conference was coming, I think you guys put out a call for presentations. And I talked to a few people, and I part of me wanted to submit. And then I was having a conversation, and I realized, well, it's not just me who would have to come. My wife would have to come with me, because going to a conference is one thing, but going to Las Vegas, to the last place I placed my bet, was another. And I don't think I was ready to do that yet. Not that I would have gotten in, but just to put in the presentation, I had to think long and hard about that, whether or not that was a good idea. And so I decided against it, because I don't know that I'm there yet mentally to be able to go.
And the conference itself is at a casino, I have to say, which throws some people for a loop. But it really, you know,
it makes sense. You're in Las Vegas.
A little bit. Yeah. Most of the conference facilities are connected to gaming organizations, but also, you know, the Suncoast, which is part of Boyd Gaming, they've been a sponsor for quite a few years, and they cut us, quite a few deals in terms of the cost of the rooms and the facilities and the meals and things like that. We always have that conversation. Should we, try to find a place that is offsite? Because I'm undoubtedly there are people who are in recovery, and especially early recovery, who would definitely balk at the idea of going to a conference that is in a casino. And in fact, there are these conversations even about having, national conferences here. About the kind of disconnect. And then it always leads back to the conversation we've already had about how do you live in Las Vegas, right? If you're in recovery from a problem, a gambling problem. But the truth is, and the truth is with any addiction, you'll find a way to nurture that in any place, whether it's legal or not. And in more and more and more places, it's legal to a greater and greater degree. So
Are you is Las Vegas 100% online now? I mean, can you gamble? Because I know in Las Vegas, they want you to go to the facilities. That's what it's built upon.
So, yeah. So we've gone there with sports wagering. We'd been there with online poker for a while. But until very, very recently, Sheldon Adelson, until his death early last year, and he was kind of, he was the head of Las Vegas Sands, had been a very outspoken opponent of iGaming and any online type of gambling. And so everyone had more or less sort of fallen in line behind him on that. But I think with the advent of the pandemic, realization that lots of other markets were headed in that direction, those conversations started up again. And we've especially seen that with sports wagering at this point. Until very recently, most of those were still in-house. And then for a while you had to go in and actually register your account, at least in-house, and then you could gamble within state lines and things like that. I think they may have just got rid of that restriction, but a lot of people think that ultimately iGaming is coming, right? And it's going to be there. That opens up a whole other conversation about responsible gambling tools and what they need to be in the electronic realm and how do we keep people safe, because with electronic gaming, you can totally isolate yourself from any social connection. You know, yeah. Your couch now is your casino, and your app is on the phone is the way to access the casino potentially. The confluence of that with sports wagering, proposition bets. So now that you can stay in action throughout the entire game, and you can track exactly how far ahead you are or behind on all of your bets, which as a, you know, normal person, this isn't an issue, but for somebody like me, I'm thinking about that. And so glad it didn't exist when I was out there, because
me too,
man, whether I was ahead or behind, it was always, there was a rationalization there for me to bet more. It's like, oh, I'm down $400. I need to place more bets and try and win that back, or I'm ahead $500. I'm playing with the house's money. Now let's go crazy. You know, it was just going crazy in every area. So that's coming. One thing that we did get for the electronic apps in Las Vegas that were in the state of Nevada was the ability to self-exclude, because we do not have a self-exclusion statute here in Las Vegas. We have what they call the ability to self-limit, which simply means that a patron can tell a gaming property that they want to opt out of direct mail marketings, the ability to cash checks, the ability to have a reward card or something like that. But we do not have self-exclusion so that somebody can go in and say, I don't want you to let me gamble on your property. I want you to be able to take legal measures against me if I do. So in the electronic realm, we now have that in Nevada, and we're hoping that opens the door to a more robust and actual self-exclusion opportunity, because that can be an important tool for people who, especially those who have gambled at just one or two places, to have that additional psychological boost to get into recovery. Because there's, almost any grocery store or bar or convenience store in Nevada is also a mini casino, right? Albertsons has 10 or 12 video poker machines waiting for you on the way out your door with your groceries. So
that's so, what an odd feeling that gives me, because I used to think, people can see how much time I'm spending here at the casino if they've just been watching a little bit. That, I always felt like the eyes were on me, even though they never were. But to sit in a grocery store then and with the behavior of a problem gambler, just because that grocery store, I'm sure, doesn't have any problematic gaming training that they're going to help somebody with that. I assume you run into that in Las Vegas all over for these, like if you're at the airport and you have behaviors that would tell somebody in a casino, maybe we should intervene. You're not going to get that at the airport, correct?
Well, that's probably true. They're not going to intervene, but I will say that gaming licensees, large or small, are required to provide their employees with some training on problem gambling, what that is. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. In some cases, it literally probably is read this brochure and tell people where to find it if they ask about it, right? And that could technically satisfy the state requirements for training. I mean, thankfully, with most of the larger organizations, especially the tourist-focused ones on the Strip, the MGM properties, the Caesars, the Las Vegas Sands, they take this issue quite a bit more seriously. I think some of that is related to stronger regulation in other markets where they have properties and they decided to kind of just go property-wide. But a lot of it is having people in those administrative positions now that have experience among their friends and coworkers and maybe family members who really understand that this is a serious impact for some people. And Las Vegas Sands and Caesars properties, they train a subset of employees to be what they call responsible gaming ambassadors. And those individuals are trained to have that intervention with a patron who is overheard making distressing comments, maybe by the cocktail waitress. And all of a sudden she comes up to one of these RG ambassadors and says, Mary over here, I just overheard her say that, she can't go home tonight because her husband thinks she's out of town or she's gambled her whole paycheck away, right? And so that person will have a discreet, they're not going to embarrass them at all, but have a discreet conversation and say, hey, we want you to be having fun. We overheard you say something that makes us think that maybe you're not. Can I share these resources with you? So imagine if you are someone who has just started to struggle or maybe is in the depths of despair and you think that this place exists for no other reason than to take everything that you have, and having somebody from that property come up to you and express concern. I mean, that could be a pretty huge moment for some people, right, who have never been approached by anybody else. And so I think it's fantastic. It's something, 10 or 15 years ago, you never would have seen, I think, in the industry, at least in the U.S. And so, I'm very grateful to, even be directly involved with some of those trainings and being able to talk with employees about, here's the face of a person with a gambling problem, probably not your stereotype, right, of what you think it looks like. And so it's really cool that we see that more and more within industry.
Well, Ted, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate talking to you again. It's always a pleasure.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thanks for having me back, Brian.
Before you go, though, to that individual who might be listening, who wants help but isn't quite there yet, do you have any words of wisdom or experience that you'd like to share?
I'll just say that, you're not alone. You may feel like you're alone and that nobody else understands what's going on in your life. You may recognize that you've done a lot of harm to your family or friends, and they may not even know about it. You don't know how to broach that subject, but recognize that wherever you are, there is one number that will work nationwide. You can search for others wherever you are in the States, but that 1-800-522-4700 will connect you with somebody who can let you know about resources in your area. And then you can make decisions about which ones to reach out to get help, as can family members, by the way, of people who are affected by somebody else's gambling problem. Very important to know that they can start the healing process regardless of whether the person with the gambling problem is ready to get help or not themselves.
It's important to know as well for the family. Thank you for saying that. And thanks everybody for listening. Go ahead and check out the NevadaCouncil.org. for all the information on the Nevada Council on Problem Gambling. I always have to remind myself that it's not the Las Vegas Council. It is the Nevada Council.
We are statewide, yes.
Yes, got to remember that. Thank you, Ted, and thanks everybody for listening.
This podcast is owned by Lee Street Media, LLC. Music provided by T-Vance. Remember, This is a podcast. The views expressed on the podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests. If you need help for a gambling addiction, please seek professional help.